This is Audible.
Highbridge Audio presents Blown to Bits by Philip Evans and Thomas S. Worcester. Read for you by Jeff David.
In 1768, three Scottish printers began publishing an integrated compendium of knowledge, the earliest and most famous encyclopedia in the English-speaking world. They called it Encyclopedia Britannica. Since then, Britannica has evolved through 15 editions, and to this day, it is generally regarded as the world's most comprehensive and authoritative encyclopedia. In 1920, Sears Roebuck and Company, an American mail-order retailer, acquired Britannica and moved its headquarters from Edinburgh to Chicago. Ownership passed to William Benton in 1941, who then willed the company in the early 1970s to the Benton Foundation, a charitable organization whose income supports communications programs at the University of Chicago. Britannica grew under its American owners into a serious commercial enterprise, while sustaining its reputation as the world's most prestigious and comprehensive encyclopedia. The content was revised every 4 or 5 years. Brand extensions such as atlases and yearbooks were added. The company built one of the most aggressive and successful direct sales forces in the world. By targeting middle-income families and focusing on their aspirations for their children, the company developed a marketing proposition as compelling as the intellectual content of the product itself. By 1990, sales of Britannica's multi-volume sets had reached an all-time peak of about $650 million. Dominant market share, steady if unspectacular growth, generous margins, and a 200-year history all testified to an extraordinarily compelling and stable brand. Since 1990, however, sales of Britannica and of all printed encyclopedias in the United States have collapsed by over 80%. Britannica was blown away by a product of the late 20th century information revolution, the CD-ROM. The CD-ROM came from nowhere and destroyed the printed encyclopedia business. Whereas Britannica sells for $1,500 to $2,200 per set, depending on the quality of the binding, CD-ROM encyclopedias such as Encarta, Grolier, and Compton list for $50 to $70. But hardly anybody pays even that. The vast majority of copies are given away to promote the sale of computers and peripherals. With a marginal manufacturing cost of $1.50 per copy, the CD-ROM as freebie makes good economic sense. The marginal cost of Britannica, in contrast, is about $250 for production, plus about $500 to $600 for the salesperson's commission. Judging from their inaction, Britannica's executives at first seem to have viewed the CD-ROM encyclopedia as an irrelevance, a child's toy, one step above video games. This perception was entirely reasonable. Microsoft had licensed the text for its encyclopedia from Funk and Wagnalls, whose third-rate, nearly defunct product, surviving as a periodic promotional item in the aisles of supermarkets, was perceived to be a brand so pathetic that Microsoft dropped its name in favor of the ad agency coinage Encarta. The addition of public domain illustrations and scratchy sound recordings too old to bear a copyright and therefore available at no cost hardly made for a serious rival to the Britannica, or so it seemed. As revenues plunged, it became obvious that whether they ought to be or not, CD-ROM encyclopedias were serious competition. Britannica executives reluctantly considered creating their own CD-ROM product, only to encounter a technology constraint. The content of Britannica was too big for the medium. Encarta, with its 7 million words, could fit easily onto a CD-ROM with plenty of room for illustrations and interactivity. Britannica, however, had more than 40 million words. It was impossible to create an interactive version within the capacity limits of a CD-ROM. The technology was not ready for the content, so the company's executives decided to wait. Months passed, Sales continued to plummet. In response, the company put together a text-only CD-ROM version of Britannica, only to encounter another crisis, a revolt by the sales force. Even if priced at a significant premium over Encarta, a CD-ROM version of Britannica could not possibly generate the $500 to $600 sales commission of the printed product, from which it would so obviously take sales. Indeed, a CD-ROM product would have to be sold through a completely different channel. To avert a revolt by the sales force, Britannica executives decided to bundle the CD-ROM as a free bonus for buyers of the multi-volume set. Anyone who wanted to buy the CD-ROM alone would have to pay $1,000. This decision appeased the sales force briefly, but did nothing to stem the continuing collapse of sales. Losses mounted. There was no apparent strategy. In May of 1995, the Benton Foundation finally put the company up for sale. For nearly 18 months, investment bankers tried to find a buyer. Microsoft said no. Technology, media, and information companies all declined. Finally, in 1996, financier Jacob Safra agreed to buy the company, paying less than half of book value. The decline and fall of Encyclopedia Britannica is more than a parable about the dangers of complacency. It illustrates what we will call the new economics of information. How the evolving technological capabilities for sharing and using information can transform business definitions, industry definitions, and competitive advantage. It illustrates how the most stable of industries, the most focused of business models, and the strongest of brands can be blown to bits by new information technology. The Britannica story contains morals for all businesses. The first is obvious. The most venerable can prove the most vulnerable. New information technologies can come from nowhere and demolish brands and businesses that have been established for decades, even centuries. One of the greatest brand names in the English-speaking world was nearly destroyed in just 5 years by a cheap, shiny disc. The second point is a bit less obvious. The history, the myths, the shared values, and the unreflective presuppositions that define a strong corporate culture can blind business leaders to events that do not fit into their collective mental framework. Britannica's executives initially scoffed at Encarta because its content was based on a promotional item sold in supermarkets. But their own market research told them that the typical encyclopedia is opened less than once a year, once the initial pride in ownership fades. Their own salespeople knew full well that the way to sell an encyclopedia is to play on anxieties, parents trying to do something for their kids. The fact that the kid never uses the product is beside the point. Parental guilt has been duly assuaged. But today, when parents are anxious about their children's performance in school, when they feel guilty about not doing enough to help, they buy a computer. The new PC may never be used for anything other than chat rooms and video games, but parental guilt has again been duly salved. It just so happens that the computer costs about the same amount as Britannica. And along with that computer comes a CD-ROM drive. And along with the CD-ROM drive come several free CD-ROMs, one of which is a promotional copy of Encarta. In other words, if the fundamental value proposition is assuaging parental guilt, then the fundamental competitor is not Encarta. It is the PC. Encarta is merely the icing on the cake. Supermarket brands and intellectual content have precious little to do with it, but within the mindset of executives in the business, steeped in a culture of scholarly values and self-confident from a history of unbroken success, it is extraordinarily hard to understand early enough that conventional industry definitions are obsolete. There is a third lesson. Even if the executives of established businesses fully grasp the impact of new technologies, and even if they can reason their way beyond their corporate myths and assumptions, they still face a massive competitive disadvantage arising precisely because they are incumbents. Incumbents are saddled with legacy assets, not just clunky mainframe systems, but sales and distribution systems, bricks and mortar, brands and core competencies. Competing in the face of the new economics of information requires cannibalizing those assets, perhaps even destroying them. Incumbents hesitate to do that, especially as long as the business has positive margins. Rather, they do complex financial calculations and get bogged down in internal political debates. Insurgents have no such inhibitions. Britannica's sales force had been built over decades. It was a foundation of competitive advantage and the envy of the industry. It was obsolete. An aggressive strategy for the new medium would have required blowing it up. The company hesitated. Microsoft had no reason to hesitate. This is a real shift. In the vast majority of traditional competitive situations, the defense has the advantage. But when the economics of information are shifting, insurgents are advantaged precisely by their lack of legacy systems, legacy assets, and a legacy mindset. Having nothing to lose becomes an advantage. The destabilization of competitive advantage is as much an opportunity as it is a threat. It just depends on how strategists choose to look at it. One consequence of the obsolescence of industry and business boundaries is that every incumbent under traditional business definitions is free to play the insurgent under some other definition. There is a fourth lesson. This is not a zero-sum game. The total value of the players can rise or fall dramatically. The game can be a massively positive sum. In book retailing, total shareholder value has gone up significantly. It can be a massively negative sum. In the encyclopedia business, shareholder value collapsed, perhaps by an order of magnitude. Britannica clearly lost, but it is not obvious that Microsoft or anybody else won. In dollar terms, sales of encyclopedias of all kinds are one-tenth of what they were in 1990. Microsoft never succeeded in getting to the price point it expected. Consumers rarely trade up from last year's promotional version to this year's fully priced version. Consumers benefit if they ever use the product, but the industry is essentially destroyed. It is not clear that anybody will ever again write works of scholarship comparable to the greatest editions of Britannica, at least not in the same form. But there is hope. Britannica, under its new management, has produced a moderately successful CD-ROM product. It goes far beyond its competitors, not only in quality and sheer volume, but in transcending the CD-ROM's limitations and connecting directly to the World Wide Web. The new Britannica aims to become the portal to a universe of high-quality, objective, scholarly material. The brand guarantees, as do few others, the seriousness and reliability of the content. The hope is to rise above the clutter and mediocrity that have proliferated in the early years of the Internet and build anew something of permanent value. The identity of that something and the challenge of building it under the vagaries of shifting economics of information are the themes of this program. Information and Things. Britannica is an information business, but that does not make it special. Every business is an information business. In many businesses not widely considered information businesses, information plays a surprisingly critical role. For example, about one-third of the cost of healthcare in the United States, some $350 billion, consists of the cost of capturing, storing, processing, and retrieving information. Patient records, cost accounting, and insurance claims. By that measure, healthcare is a larger information industry than the so-called information industry. The physical world of manufacturing is shaped by information. A high-end Mercedes automobile contains as much computing power as a mid-range personal computer. Information dominates processes as well as products. It's hard to imagine how even low-tech manufacturers could compete without such information-intensive functions as market research, logistics, and advertising. Inventory and work in process are purely physical things, but if information were accurate and timely, factories could operate with a fraction of their current inventory. Inventory is merely the physical correlate of deficient information. More fundamentally, information and the mechanisms for delivering it are the glue that holds together the structure of businesses. Andrew Carnegie and Henry Ford struggled with the cost and difficulty of coordinating large-scale, complex operations. They solved the problem through proprietary information systems and hierarchic control. This gave rise to the vertically integrated value chain, defined as the sequence of activities that a business performs to design, produce, market, deliver, and support its product. Corporations, in turn, ally with each other to form the supply chains that define an industry. Supply chains link supplier and customer corporations together. They are shaped by the same kind of informational logic as the value chains within companies, but in a weaker form. A consumer franchise, similarly, describes the proprietary information that a company has about its customers and that customers have about the company. Brands are the information, whether real or imagined, intellectual or emotional, that consumers associate with a product. And the tools used to build brands, advertising, promotions, sales pitches, even the presentation of goods on a supermarket shelf, are themselves channels for delivering information. Information in all these contexts does not just mean data. Qualitative judgments, affiliation, and emotion are all part and parcel of information we exchange and are inextricably intertwined with the sharing of numbers and facts. Denotation and connotation are fundamentally inseparable. When we picture value in supply chains, we tend to visualize a linear flow of physical activities. But it is information in the broadest sense of the word that flows across these activities and binds them together. Information flows ultimately determine what is inside and what is outside the business unit, value chain, supply chain, consumer franchise, and organization. In short, information and the mechanisms for delivering it underlie much of what defines business boundaries, stabilizes corporate and industry structures, shapes the organization, and drives competitive advantage. Like the air we breathe, the importance of information is sometimes overlooked because it is so pervasive, so manifold, and so obvious. Information is the glue that holds value chains and supply chains together. But that glue is now melting. The fundamental cause is the explosion in connectivity and in the information standards that are enabling the open and almost cost-free exchange of a widening universe of rich information. When everyone can communicate richly with everyone else, the narrow, hardwired communications channels that used to tie people together simply become obsolete. And so do all the business structures that created those channels or exploit them for competitive advantage. The explosion in connectivity has taken almost everyone by surprise. Almost all knowledge workers in the United States have networked personal computers on their office desks. The daily users of Yahoo now outnumber viewers of the most popular show on television. Beginning only recently, communications capacity is exploding at a rate that dwarfs even Moore's Law, the observation first made by Gordon Moore, then chairman of Intel, that every 18 months it is possible to double the number of transistor circuits etched on a computer chip. Moore's Law implies a tenfold increase in memory and processing power every 5 years, 100-fold every 10 years, 1,000-fold every 15. This is the most dramatic rate of sustained technical progress in history. This tidal wave of universal connectivity is melting the glue bonding economic activities together, and it will separate, as nothing has separated before, the flow of information from the flow of physical things, allowing each to follow its own economics. The pure economics of a physical thing and the pure economics of a piece of information are fundamentally different. When a thing is sold, the seller ceases to own it. When an idea, a tune, or a blueprint is sold, the seller still possesses it and could possibly sell it again. Information can be replicated at almost zero cost without limit. Things can be replicated only through the expense of manufacture. Things wear out. Their performance deteriorates with wear and tear. Information never wears out, although it can become unfashionable, obsolete, or simply untrue. The economics of things is consistent with efficient markets. Fields and factories can compete against each other as price takers in competitive markets. The economics of information requires imperfect markets. Unless the originators of information have some ability to limit the access of others to it through copyright or patent or simple secrecy, they will never earn a return to justify the original investment. If there is no limit on the ability of others to copy it, owning information is worthless. If there is a limit, it is a monopoly. Either way, information does not behave like fields or factories. The economics of physical things and the economics of pure information are thus fundamentally and qualitatively different. But as long as information is embedded within a physical thing, the two kinds of economics are wedded together. Each is prevented from following its pure logic by the bond tying it to the other. But their weightings have shifted. Over the centuries, the economics of information has steadily become less tied to the economics of things, as less physically intensive media have developed for the delivery of information. In the days before widespread literacy, to take a fanciful example, the stained glass windows, altarpieces, and sculptures of a Gothic cathedral constituted an enormously capital-intensive medium for communicating information. Information did not come to people. People had to go to the information. The bundle of the physical and the informational was so overwhelmingly weighed down by the former that the economics of the latter was irrelevant. Nobody saw fit to copyright a cathedral. When technology advanced in the form of literacy and printing, however, books could communicate much the same narrative through a far less capital-intensive means. Books still had their own physically defined costs of printing, binding, inventory, and distribution, but these were far lower than the cost of a pilgrimage to Canterbury, and issues of copyright and plagiarism appeared. The advent of broadcasting permitted communication that is largely independent of the economics of things, but constrained to be one-way and monolithic. Telephone and fax have similarly freed certain kinds of communication and collaboration from the economics of things. But these media are limited by their narrow bandwidth. Digital networks finally make it possible to blow up the link between rich information and its physical carrier. The Internet stands in the same relation to television as did television to books and books to stained glass windows. The traditional link between the medium and the message, between the flow of product-related information and the product itself, between the informational value chain and the physical value chain, between the economics of information and the economics of things, is broken. The economics of information and the economics of things have been tied together like participants in a three-legged race. Every business is consequently a compromise between the economics of information and the economics of things. Separating them breaks their mutual compromise and potentially releases enormous economic value. Consider shelf space in a shop. Shelf space serves two different functions simultaneously. It is a billboard or information that tells customers what they need to know in order to make a selection. It is also inventory, a thing, the stock of goods residing between factory and consumer. If retailers chose to lay out shelves for purely informational purposes, they would maximize the display. The bigger the shelf, the richer the choice presented to the consumer. If retailers focused on physical economics, however, they would minimize the display to control the cost of inventory. But it is impossible to maximize and minimize simultaneously. So any retailer has to make a compromise between the economics of information, the billboard, and the economics of things, the inventory. Different shops make this compromise in very different ways. High-end retailers focus more on the economics of presentation. Discount retailers compete more on the economics of inventory. This compromise is ubiquitous. A newspaper publisher balances the demands of the paper's physical franchise, defined by the economics of its printing presses and trucking routes, with those of its informational franchise, defined by the universe of readers and advertisers interested in the content and readership that the newspaper delivers. Organizations balance the physical economics of location, it is more cost-effective to communicate over the telephone than to meet in person, against the informational economics of co-location. The informational exchange is richer if co-workers are meeting in the same place. This compromise between the economics of information and the economics of things suppresses economic value, but more so in some businesses than in others. In grocery retailing, the value of the product is low, inventory turns are high, and the premium placed on selection by the customer, beyond some threshold, is comparatively low. The compromise between selection and inventory is not too severe. In book retailing, however, the value of the product is high, inventory turns are very low, and the premium on selection is much higher. The informational imperative to carry high inventory and the logistical imperative to minimize it exist in strong tension with each other. Lots of economic value is suppressed. Separating the economics of things from the economics of information, allowing for electronic search independent of warehouse delivery, therefore releases far more value in bookselling than it does in grocery retailing. The implications of unraveling the informational value chain and the physical value chain, and then allowing each to evolve in accordance with its very distinct economics, are profound. Traditional business models will become deeply vulnerable wherever the compromise between the two sets of economics suppresses value. The separation will offer opportunities for companies to capitalize on either the liberated economics of information or the liberated economics of things. But none of the emergent business models needs to bear much resemblance to its antecedent. Information, in short, may be the end product of only a minority of businesses, but it glues together value chains, supply chains, consumer franchises, and organizations across the entire economy. And it accounts for a grossly disproportionate share of competitive advantage and therefore of profits. The advent of rich connectivity and information standards, as we will soon see, melts the informational glue that binds activities and participants together. It also allows an informational value chain to separate from the physical chain. Since the economics of information and the economics of physical things are fundamentally different, this can release tremendous economic value, value that was suppressed by their mutual compromise. For the custodian of any established business, this has disturbing implications. It suggests that a business may no longer exist. The component pieces may separate as the informational glue bonding them together melts. It suggests that the informational and physical activities could unravel and indeed could fly apart because their underlying economics are so different. It suggests that some competitor could focus on a vulnerable sliver of the current value chain where the incumbent is competitively disadvantaged, or where the incumbent makes all its profit and could appropriate just that piece. It suggests that all the incumbent's confidence about business definition, competitor threats, and competitive advantage, grounded doubtless in decades of competitive success, may be no more justified than it was for Britannica. Richness and reach. To the extent that information is embedded in physical modes of delivery, a basic law governs its economics. There is a universal trade-off between richness and reach. But unbundle information from its physical carrier, and the richness-reach trade-off can blow up. The trade-off is fairly simple. Richness means the quality of information as defined by the user. Accuracy, bandwidth, currency, customization, interactivity, relevance, security, and so forth. The precise meaning of richness varies from one context to another, but in any one context, it is generally clear what the word means. Reach means the number of people who participate in the sharing of that information. Here are some definitions of richness and reach. Reach is easy to understand. It simply means the number of people at home or at work exchanging information. The definition of richness of information is a bit more complex. It concerns six aspects of information. Bandwidth, or the amount of information that can be moved from sender to receiver in a given time. Stock quotes are narrowband. A feature film is broadband. The degree to which the information can be customized. An advertisement on television is far less customized than a personal sales pitch, but reaches many more people. Interactivity. Dialogue is possible for a small group, but to reach millions, the message must be a monologue. Reliability. Information is reliable when exchanged among a small group of trusted individuals, but is not when it is circulating among a large group of strangers. Security. Managers share highly sensitive business information only in closed-door meetings, but they will disseminate less sensitive information to a wider audience. Currency. On Wall Street, where seconds count, a few market makers have instantaneous quotes. A larger group of financial institutions receives quotes with a 3 to 15 minute delay, and most retail investors receive quotes with at least a 15 minute delay. Until recently, it has been possible to share extremely rich information with a very small number of people and less rich information with a larger number. But it has been impossible to share simultaneously as much richness and reach as one would like. This trade-off is at the heart of the old economics of information. Communicating rich information has required proximity, people working in the same physical location, or dedicated channels such as proprietary computer networks, retail stores, or a sales force. The costs or physical constraints of these channels, however, have limited the number of people who can access the information. Conversely, communicating information to a large audience has required compromises in the quality of that information. Technologies have not allowed us to achieve simultaneously as much richness and reach as we would like. Consider, for example, the alternative information channels through which sellers persuade buyers. Newspaper advertisements reach a wide range of possible customers with limited, static content. Direct mail and telemarketing are a bit richer in customization and interactivity, but much more expensive and therefore have to be targeted. Relative to advertisers, direct marketers give up reach in order to add richness. A salesman giving his pitch offers the highest level of personalization, dialogue, and empathy, but with only one customer at a time. The marketing mix is thus the apportionment of information resources across a trade-off between richness and reach. Buyers live with and adapt to the same trade-off. It forces them to search hierarchically. They have to navigate their way from high-reach, low-richness information sources, such as the phone book, which offers only contact information but reaches a wide universe of sellers, to high-richness, low-reach sources, such as the salesman, who offers to a single customer richly detailed, interactive, and personalized information about his own limited range of wares. For consumers, brand knowledge is simply a high-richness, low-reach stock of information that short-circuits the laborious task of hierarchical search. Supply chains exhibit the same trade-off. When companies conduct business with one another, the number of parties they deal with is inversely proportional to the richness of the information they need to exchange. Citibank's currency traders source euros and yen from hundreds of institutions precisely because the informational richness needed to support currency trading amounts to just two numbers, quantity and price. Currency traders do not need to build relationships or swap favors, even with their colleagues at the next desk. The information requirements of the business put a far higher premium on reach than they do on most kinds of informational richness. Conversely, Toyota and Walmart have narrowed their reach by moving to fewer and larger long-term supplier contracts to allow a richer coordination of marketing and logistics. They built sophisticated systems for electronic data interchange, or EDI, with their suppliers, But the enormous cost of custom installation to bring the supply systems into mutual compatibility forced these companies to narrow their sourcing to the largest and most capable vendors. Japanese manufacturers became well known in the 1980s for deliberately narrowing their supply base in this fashion, and then closely collaborating with their suppliers to maximize quality and minimize inventory and delivery time. They gained richness at the sacrifice of reach. The array of sourcing strategies with Citibank at one extreme and Toyota and Walmart at the other reflects the trade-off between richness and reach. More generally, the hierarchical structure of supply chains, in which each participant deals only with its immediate suppliers and its immediate customers, reflects another aspect of the trade-off. It is too difficult and too expensive for everyone to have rich and directly collaborative relations with everyone else in an industry. Organizations support rich information exchange among their limited group of employees or members, whereas markets trade in less rich information among a wider universe. The boundary of the corporation is thus a point on the trade-off between richness and reach. Within a corporation, traditional concepts of span of control and hierarchical reporting are predicated on the fact that communication cannot be rich and broad-reaching simultaneously. Jobs are structured to channel rich communication among a few people standing in a hierarchical relationship to one another, upward or downward, and broader communication is effected through the indirect routes of the organizational pyramid. Relationships among and within corporations, as well as with retail customers, loyalty to a product or an employer, and trust of a person or a brand are all the products of rich exchanges of information among people who, by doing so, have narrowed the reach of their options. The marketing mix, searching and switching behavior, branding, retail franchises, supply chain relationships, organization, indeed, even the boundaries of the corporation, all are built on this pervasive, universal, and obvious trade-off between richness and reach. In all these contexts, the trade-off between richness and reach generates asymmetries of information, differences in knowledge among people or companies that affect their bargaining power. Someone selling a used car knows more about its faults than does the buyer. Eliminate the richness-reach trade-off, make the channel universally accessible, and the asymmetry collapses. And that is precisely what is beginning to happen. Digital networks are now making it possible for a very large number of people to exchange very rich information. The richness-reach trade-off is being displaced and, in some cases, obliterated. Once information can travel by itself and there are standards that allow everyone to share that information, it becomes possible to have richness and reach. This blow-up of the trade-off between richness and reach is creating a new economics of information. And with the blow-up go the behavioral patterns, institutions, and asymmetries that have defined marketing, supply chains, organization, and the boundaries of the corporation. Two forces drive the displacement of the richness-reach trade-off: the explosion of connectivity and the adoption of common information standards. Electronic networks allow information to flow largely independently of the economics of things. Liberated from the constraint of a physical carrier, information can flow with negligible cost of delivery, customization, or delay. Connectivity alone, however, is not sufficient to break the trade-off between richness and reach. The second requirement is common standards. The rapid emergence of universal technical standards for communication, which allows everybody to communicate with everybody else at essentially zero cost, constitutes a sea change. In many ways, this development is the more profound of the two transformations taking place. The internet, extranets, and intranets are all variants on exactly the same thing. They use a set of lowest common denominator technical standards. These triumph because of the principle of good enough. At some point in the advance of a technology, generic standards become good enough for their advantages in universal acceptance to outweigh their disadvantages in any specific application. Over just the past 5 years, Lowest common denominator standards have swept the board for static textual information where security and speed are not critical, that is, HTML as a standard for presenting text. Over the next 10 years, many other types of information will succumb to the same principle. Mission-critical, higher-volume applications, collaborative and distributed processing, confidential data, voice, full-screen, high-definition audio, and video entertainment. There are no fundamental technical barriers to building standards because memory and processing power continue to be driven by Moore's Law, and bandwidth is exploding. For some applications, there is legitimate argument over when. There can be no real argument over whether. It is connectivity and standards together that displace the trade-off between richness and reach. They allow advising, alerting, authenticating, bidding, collaborating, comparing, informing, searching, specifying, and switching with a richness that is constrained only by the underlying standards and a reach that is constrained only by the number of players connected and using that standard. As the trade-off between richness and reach blows up, economic relationships in all their manifestations will change radically. A sales force, a system of branches, a printing press, a chain of stores, or a delivery fleet, which once served as formidable barriers to entry because they took years and heavy investment to build, will suddenly become expensive liabilities. New competitors will come from nowhere to steal customers. Similarly, the replacement of expensive proprietary legacy systems with inexpensive open extranets will make it easier for companies to bid for supply contracts, join a virtual factory, or form a competing supply chain. Inside large corporations, the emergence of universal open standards for exchanging information over intranets will foster cross-functional teams and will accelerate the demise of hierarchical structures and their proprietary information systems. When everyone can exchange rich information without constraints on reach, the channel choices for marketers, the inefficiencies of consumer search, the hierarchical structure of supply chains, the organizational pyramid, asymmetries of information, and the boundaries of the corporation itself will all be thrown into question. The competitive advantages that depended on them will be challenged. The business structures that had been shaped by them will fall apart. We call this process of transformation deconstruction. Over the next 5 to 10 years, many relationships throughout the business world will deconstruct. It is already beginning to happen. Deconstruction. Deconstruction is the dismantling and reformulation of traditional business structures. It results from two forces: the separation of the economics of information from the economics of things, and the blow-up within the economics of information of the trade-off between richness and reach. Traditional business structures include value chains, supply chains, organizations, and consumer franchises. When the trade-off between richness and reach is blown up, there is no longer a need for the components of these business structures to be integrated. The new economics of information blows all these structures to bits. The pieces will then recombine into new business structures based on the separate economics of information and things. Consider the newspaper business. It has a vertically and horizontally integrated value chain. Journalists and advertisers supply copy, editors and sub-editors lay it out, the press prints the physical product, and an elaborate distribution system delivers it to readers each morning. Newspapers exist and can survive and profit as intermediaries between journalists and readers because of the economies of scale in the printing press. Writers cannot reach readers directly because they cannot cheaply print and distribute their work alone. Given its economies of scale, it makes sense for the newspaper to bundle multiple news services together, and it makes further sense to add in all the other material that benefits from the same method of reproduction and distribution. Classifieds, display advertisements, inserts, stock quotes, features, cartoons, TV listings, and so forth. These products cross-subsidize each other. Some pull in particular segments of readers, others pull in particular segments of advertisers. All contribute to the overall fixed costs of production and distribution. Gurus have been forecasting for years the possibility of a high-resolution electronic tablet newspaper, which would be loaded with daily content over the phone line, support full-motion video, offer all the advantages of electronic intelligence, and cost less per day than the price of a paper newspaper. Like the equally famous paperless office, it has not happened yet, and is not likely to become popular in the foreseeable future. As newspaper executives point out, the broadsheet is an extraordinarily cheap, convenient, and user-friendly way to distribute information. Electronic tablets are not going to replace it very soon. However, that response is to misunderstand the nature of the challenge facing newspapers. It assumes that the transformation of the business is an all-or-nothing proposition. The question is not whether and when newspapers will go electronic. The question is more basic. Will newspapers still remain a vertically and horizontally integrated business? Deconstruction posits a melting of the glue that binds the newspaper value chain together. The glue in this case is the economics of things, printing presses and distribution, tying together the informational content. Once other means of distribution become possible, the bundle can no longer be taken for granted. Liberated from the economics of things, journalists will be able to email content directly to readers. Readers will be able to mix and match content from an unlimited number of sources. They will be able to download news daily, or several times a day, from multiple news services. They will be able to obtain movie reviews, travel features, and recipes directly from magazines, book publishers, and master chefs. Star columnists, cartoonists, or the U.S. Weather Service can send their content directly to subscribers. Intermediaries, internet portals, intelligent agents, formatting software, or for that matter, editorial teams, can format and package content to meet readers' individual interests. The Daily Us of the traditional newspaper could be replaced by a customized Daily Me. Almost all these things are already happening. Online journalism is burgeoning. Most traditional newspaper content is available somewhere on the web. Portals offer quite sophisticated customization of home pages, including online tracking of an investment portfolio, continuous weather updates, local entertainment listings, and alerts on topics of special interest. But still, convenient and nifty as these services are, there is little evidence that they are drawing readers away from the daily newspaper. However, deconstruction does not have to occur, indeed rarely will occur, across the board. Deconstruction does not mean that the newspaper business as a whole is vulnerable, but rather that the critical pieces of the business are vulnerable. Classified advertising is a natural online product. When posted and accessed electronically, classified advertisers can offer continuously updated listings, extensive text and pictures, prospectively even video clips. Buyers can search systematically by whatever criteria they choose, set alerts, access related information, and respond via email. The inconvenience of booting a computer is a minor consideration when selling a car or buying a house. The migration of classified advertising has a compelling logic and is already well underway. However, classifieds account for about 40% of the revenues of the typical newspaper, but only 10% of its costs. The 30% contribution from classifieds is well in excess of the margin of just about every newspaper in the